You're too damn white, guys.
All right, welcome back to another Two Damn White Guys. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Ritter.
And today we are joined by the one and only Oded Gaylor, the Herbert H. Goldberger Professor of Economics at Brown University, founder of Unified Growth Theory, author of Discrete Dynamical Systems and Unified Growth Theory. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Oded. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And today we are really excited to talk about some findings that you made in 2002, which were corroborated by a paper you released this year, 2019, April 1st. This theory is groundbreaking in how we perceive economics and how civilizations grow, but it's also potentially controversial. I don't know if it's controversial. I need you to explain this to me a little more, which is part of the reason you're here. But we kind of want to better understand unified growth theory and what it means, and why you were interested in researching this to begin with. So could you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. So my interest was fundamentally to understand global inequality across nations, why some nations are poor and others are rich. And in fact, unified growth is trying to resolve two fundamental mysteries. One mystery can be defined as the mystery of growth, and the other one is the mystery of the gap in the wealth of nations. So let me start with the mystery of growth. If you review the evidence about the process of development over the entire course of human history, there is a very striking element in this pattern of development. Over most of human existence, societies, individuals, nations are living very close to a state of stagnation. There are minor fluctuations in their income per capita. When technology arrives, there is a temporary increase in income per capita. But ultimately, the standard of living reverts back to a level that is very close to subsistence.
This is Malthusian economics?
Yes, so this is the Malthusian epoch. And during the Malthusian epoch that lasted perhaps for 300,000 years, namely since the emergence of Homo sapiens until the eve of industrialization, as I said, what we see is that gradually the size of the population is increasing. And technological progress becomes faster and faster and faster. But nevertheless, technological progress, unlike today's world, is not converted into the material well-being of the population. It's not converted into richer people. It is converted into more people. So much of the gain in productivity is converted into supporting larger and larger population that still enjoys the same level of income per capita. And then, about 200 years ago, in the course of industrialization, we see this dramatic increase in income per capita. Over a 200-year period, income per capita in the world economy is increasing 14-fold, whereas over the entire course of human existence, it hardly changed. And this change is part of what is trying to be explained by unified growth theory. Why is it the case that literally over most of human existence, we do not see any change in the standard of living, and then suddenly we see this fantastic increase in income per capita in the past two centuries? So think about it in the context of a very simple metaphor. So when I'm sitting in my office here, I can see squirrels that are basically peeping through my window and are looking at me. If you think about these squirrels and you think about their ancestors, those that lived in the forest that existed here 5,000 years ago, 500 years ago, 50,000 years ago, their living standard didn't change. They are in the same level of income per capita throughout. If you compare them to their relatives in India, or in Tanzania, or in Kenya, the standard of living will not differ. But when you look at humans were not very different than these squirrels up till about 200 years ago. But then suddenly, something very dramatic occurred in the human population, and suddenly we move into a world in which for us, sustained economic growth and sustained progress is a synonym to the period in which we live. So this was one of the mysteries that unified growth theory wanted to explain. The second one was what I defined as the mystery of the gaps. Why is it the case that we see this tremendous gap in the income per capita across societies? So if you look at the world in the year one, at the time of Jesus, and you look at the most advanced region of the world, and you compare it to the most regressed region of the world, the ratio of income per capita between the richest region and the poorest region is nearly 1.2 to 1, negligible. Even if you look at the world in the year 1800, okay, only 200 years ago, the ratio is about 3 to 1. Okay, so Western Europe is the most prosperous region of the world. You compare Western Europe to Africa, the ratio is about 3 to 1. And then within 200-year period, we see this great divergence in the wealth of nations. Some nations are 100 times richer than others. Some regions, Western Europe, Western offshoots, are nearly 20 times richer than the poorest regions of the world. And naturally, the question is why? And actually, if you think about the metaphor that I was using before, if you think about this takeoff, then this takeoff that is generating a 14-fold increase in income per capita in the world economy is not occurring at the same time period across different regions. Some regions of the world are taking off first, others with some delay, and consequently, there is a huge increase in income per capita. If, say, Western Europe is taking off about 150 years earlier than Africa, this implies that they moved already 14-fold in their income per capita relative to the initial position. This generates an enormous gap. So a lot of what unified growth theory does is to try to explain these elements. And the explanation is basically based on a theory that is trying to understand how societies, humans, evolve over the entire course of history, from 300,000 years ago in Africa till today. And the idea is basically to generate an economic model that can basically follow the Malthusian epoch and ultimately spontaneously generate an increase in income per capita as we observe in the course of industrialization, and ultimately the gap in income per capita across the globe.
Would you briefly describe Malthusian economics just for the casual listener who may not know what you're talking about? Because I feel like that's kind of key to understanding what you're talking about.
Indeed. So the Malthusian epoch is a time period in which, as I said earlier, there is some technological progress that is taking place, not as rapid as in today's world, but technology is advancing. But when technology is advancing, it doesn't end up leading in the long run to richer people, but simply more people. And what is the idea? Suppose that you have a given amount of land, okay? And suppose that someone innovated and you can use a plow on your land, and consequently the crop that you can generate from the land is larger than before. Now, naturally, initially, you will have more crops. You share it with your family, and ultimately, some of it will be shared by having more children than before. A generation after, you have the same amount of land, now it will be cultivated by your children, but there are more of them. So the ratio of the amount of land to the amount of people that we have is reverting ultimately back to what existed in the initial position. So when technology arrived, people are temporarily richer than before. They can consume more, they can sustain more children than before, but the fact that they can sustain more children than before implies that in the next generation, more people will cultivate the same amount of land with slightly better technology, but since there are more of them, in the end, the number of loaves of bread per person will revert back to the previous equilibrium position.
So it's about sustainability and how many resources are available for each person in that area. And I guess what unified growth theory is all about is exploring this phenomenon that we see recently in history where we're no longer limited by Malthusian standards. And why is that, I guess, is what you're after.
So when we think about the process of development, there's three fundamental phases. The Malthusian epoch that we just talked about, the post-Malthusian regime in which we start to see a takeoff in income per capita. This is a time in which we see an enormous spike in population as well. And ultimately, the modern growth regime, it is basically emerging once the demographic transition is taking place. Once, in fact, people change their preferences with respect to children, they have less of them, but consequently, an increase in technology or improvement in technology and an increase in income per capita is not being counterbalanced by a larger population.
I want to get to causes, because I think that's one of the areas where there might be some controversy, because it sounds like what you're describing is merely the product of exponential technological growth, because as you get things like the Green Revolution recently, but in the past, mechanization of agriculture, it means each farmer can be more productive, you can have more people living in the cities, you see massive urbanization, which means that more people can specialize in industry and developing technologies and building factories and all these sort of inventing things. So it seems like what you're describing is merely the exponential growth of technology and the impacts of that. But I think one of the things that you've connected it to is actually literally the evolution of humans, so a biological change. You did some studies looking at birth rates, birth records in Quebec, and how people who had children later were less fecund, basically had just genetically and biologically had children later naturally. It was actually an advantage in a more technological world, whereas previously it would have been a massive disadvantage to have fewer children. And not just the choice of having fewer children, but the actual biology causing them to have fewer children. So to what degree do you attribute it to actual evolution of humans, or what other causes do you identify as the main components of your theory?
Okay, so there are two segments of my theory. One of them that is independent of evolutionary processes, and another one that is intimately linked to evolutionary processes. So in order to understand the segment that is built upon evolutionary processes, we need to understand what the theory suggests about the transition from stagnation to growth. And the idea is very simple. The idea is that we start, say, with Adam and Eve long ago, and Adam and Eve are innovating sooner or later. Technology is advanced, and consequently, with better technology, we can support more population. We have more population. This allows us to have more innovators, more demand for innovations, and as a result of it, technology is moving forward again. As technology is moving forward, we can support more people. And therefore, there is a positive feedback loop between population and technology for a long period of time. So if you look at the world at the time of Jesus, the size of the population of the world is slightly below 200 million people. If you look at the size of the population in the eve of industrialization, it's about 750 million people. So though the world is in a state of Malthusian stagnation in terms of the standard of living, population is increasing fourfold. And as you suggested, at the same time, there is a gradual increase in the rate of technological progress. So during this period, we see this positive feedback between population and technology, but income per capita is just fluctuating tremendously. People are not getting richer. And then we reach a point in which technology starts to evolve so rapidly, and this occurs around the time of industrialization, that human capital, education, is needed in order to cope with this rapidly changing technological environment. But people have limited resources. In order to support the education of their children, they need to economize on the number of children. And this is the time in which we start to see the demographic transition, the decline in fertility, that permits societies to benefit from the fruits of technology rather in the context of their material well-being rather than in the context of larger population, and this brings the world into the sustained growth regime. So the mechanism that I just described is independent of evolutionary processes. It's just based on the interaction between the scale of the population and technology.
So it's not that it's actually changing our biological makeup. It's just that that because of how technologically advanced we're becoming, we can change up our lifestyle a bit.
Precisely. So that's one element. So when I think about the sort of unified growth theory, I think about three fundamental wheels that are operating the system: the scale of the population, technological progress, and the composition of the population. And the composition of the population is related to the question that you ask. So suppose that we start in society with certain type of, different type of people, heterogeneity in people. Naturally, we know that in the Malthusian world, people that will have more resources will have higher reproductive success. This is an evidence that is supported in the data. Unlike today's world, in which richer people do not have more children, in the ancient period, people that had more resources had higher reproductive success. Now, why is it important? If, in fact, you have higher resources because you're stronger or you have higher cognitive ability, etc., and if this trait is transmitted across generation, it implies that over time, individuals that have traits that are complementary to the technological environment are multiplied more rapidly and become more represented in the population. So the theory that I developed in 2002 that you described, which was entitled Natural Selection and the Origin of Economic Growth, suggests that over the course of human history, economic development and technological change gradually changed the composition of the human population and gave larger and larger representation for people that were more complementary to the technological environment. And ultimately, this feedback between technology and the change in the composition of the human population brought about the change that we see in the course of industrialization. Okay, so that's the second segment of the theory. This is the third wheel in the context of development. It's not the scale of the population only. Scale is important, but it's the composition of the population. Okay, the fact that we differ, and naturally, if we differ and reproductive success depends on our resources, those of us that would have productive traits that are more complementary to the technological environment will have higher income, higher reproductive success, and as a result of it, our either culture or genetic torch will be carried by more and more people over time.
So is it that people who are more, maybe adapted is the right word, people who are more adapted to modern lifestyles will have a higher income, essentially? Is that what it is?
Precisely.
So how is that not evolution?
It is evolution.
The second part is evolution, yeah.
Okay, I see what he's saying now.
He's just separating out the different parts, yeah.
Got it.
This is not sort of the mutation that is being taken over. There's different type of people in the population, and simply nature is selecting those that are more complementary, more adaptable to the environment. So, for instance, if we get into a stage in which education becomes important, okay, and some of us have higher predisposition towards investment in quality, then nature will give an evolutionary advantage to these individuals because their earning capacity will be higher and they will be able to reproduce more than their fellow members that are interested in the quantity strategy.
Is it really evolution, though? How is it not that it's just education? Could it just be education?
It's beyond education because it's if you wish, changes in the preferences of people. Okay, so if you think about two types of people, I would call them the quantity type and the quality type. People that in terms of the reproductive strategy are emphasizing quantity and others that are emphasizing quality. We certainly see it in nature. There are some species that are emphasizing quantity as their reproductive strategies, and others that are emphasizing quality. Think about these two type of people of this sort. And what the theory suggests, that during the Malthusian epoch, people that have a high predisposition towards quantity will not be selected. Those that would have some tendency to invest in quality will be the evolutionary winner. And why is it the case? Because if I invest in the quality of my children, they will have higher earning capacity, and as a result of it, higher reproductive success that will even compensate for the fact that they have a bias towards quality, and consequently, predisposition towards quality will become more and more prevalent in the population.
Maybe I'm not understanding, but it still seems like education over evolution. Like, I can't understand how we would have evolved to take on different traits for this type of lifestyle so quickly, because evolution happens so slowly. So I'm trying to understand how it's not just that people who grow up in these societies are just by default better adapted to them or something like that.
Right. So first, regarding the observation that you made, that evolution is a slow process. Indeed, if you think about the evolution of the human brain or the human eye, these are very lengthy processes. But evolution in the composition of existing traits, it can be very, very rapid. So for instance, the time period that we have in mind is the time period since the Neolithic Revolution. And there are a lot of evidence these days about major evolutionary processes that occurred since the Neolithic Revolution in the human population. For instance, lactose tolerance was emerging with the domestication of dairy animals, and naturally three great variations in lactose tolerance across the globe. The sickle cell trait that is providing people with immunity from malaria evolves since the transition to agriculture in Africa. So again, in the course of the past 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, etc. So we have plenty of evidence about changes that occur over this time period. And in this respect, when we think about changes in the composition of the human population, these changes can occur very, very rapidly. And as I said before, I mean, in order not to conflate it with issues of education, think about a very simple model. Suppose that, in fact, strength is very important, okay? And suppose that there are two types of people in the population, strong people and weak people. And suppose that strength is transmitted intergenerationally, okay? Then the stronger people will have more resources, will have more sexual mates, more children. And if, in fact, this trait is transmitted intergenerationally, after 4 or 5 generations, most of the population will have this trait of strength, okay? And it's true for strengths. It could be true for cognitive abilities. It could be true for preferences for quality. And what we model is preferences for quality. And the paper that you mentioned before, the paper about the study that was done in Quebec, is precisely supporting this building block of the tier. If you wish, I can talk to you about these particular findings.
That would be good. Real quick, though, one last question. Is it possible that technology has undoubtedly changed the way we live, and it's changed the priorities for life? So is it possible that it's not a matter of evolution, but just technology by itself?
It could be. So as I said, if you think about unified growth theory, broadly speaking, I'm considering two different wills that are operating behind the scene. One of them is the scale of the population and its interaction with technology. And the second one is potential changes in the composition of the population.
Okay, so it really is both.
Yes, so the fundamental argument is that during the Malthusian epoch, it's not only the scale of the population that is changing, it's the composition that is changing inevitably, precisely because of the reasons that I mentioned. Today, if there will be change in technology, it will not affect the composition of the population, because people that command more resources do not have necessarily higher reproductive success. But at a time period in which resources are converted into more sexual mates, and as a result of it, higher reproductive success, it will be the case that that individuals that have certain traits that are generating more resources will have higher reproductive success, and consequently, over time, their trait will become more and more prevalent in the population. And this can occur within 50 generation, 100 generation, very, very fast. I mean, this change is very, very rapid.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise.
That seems to be one of the challenges, because the escape from the Malthusian trap is really just maybe 8 to 16 generations or something in the last few hundred years, if you, you know, consider like a mean generation, 20 and 25 years.
Sorry, I'm referring to a process that is basically occurring behind the scenes since the emergence of agriculture in the past 1,000 years. So it's a change that is occurring and is not basically appearing very conspicuously till industrialization, and suddenly a certain threshold is passing and we see its effect on economic growth. But the change is occurring over 10,000 years. It's not necessarily occurring in the context of the past 200 years. So that's important to realize.
It also seems to me difficult to separate from a cultural meme, kind of, from like basically a choice. People observe their neighbors who delay having children, and then they choose to delay having children as well. It's also difficult to separate from the gender difference, which is a male historically in society who delayed having children might have more evolutionary success because they can build up the resources, but a female would be desired for as early as possible, basically, so you have older, more successful males marrying younger, more fertile females. So it's kind of difficult to disentangle that as well, being probably the most successful. So yeah, it's a struggle for me to wrap my head around the evolutionary part of that.
Right, but when I'm referring to an evolutionary process, you can think about two separate processes. You can think about evolutionary process that is changing the genetic composition of the population, or cultural evolution.
Yeah, to me it seems like a good candidate for cultural evolution.
Yes. And as we know, cultural evolution can be very, very rapid. It can occur within a generation or two. So certainly, that when we see our neighbors, and despite our predisposition, if we understand it, that education is so important for prosperity, we will mimic the behavior of prosperous individuals that are investing in education. It doesn't necessarily have to be evolutionary process that is associated with changes in the genetic composition.
That makes a lot more sense.
The other thing I'm struggling with is, it seems to me, again, technological exponential growth, but in terms of the differences in civilizations and societies, we interviewed Darren Acemoglu, Why Nations Fail, who basically argues that it's institutions that bring those differences in success and wealth of civilizations. So you can have even equal technology available, but if there's not the correct incentives for people to adopt those technologies or correct incentives to develop new technologies, because it would just get, you know, taken over by the elites in a society, in a closed society, then there's... It's basically about generating incentives through institutions and protection of the rule of law and property rights and that sort of thing that explains that. So it's a combination of those two factors, at least in I think, probably his view. So how do you disentangle that from, I guess, this evolutionary component?
Right. So unified growth theory is basically developing the foundations of the foundations of a theory that will ultimately allow us to understand the transition from stagnation to growth. But the pace of this transition may depend on many of the factors that you mentioned. So I mentioned the importance of the interaction, the positive feedback loop between population and technology. Now, naturally, we live in a society where property rights are not protected, as you said. With the same scale of population, we will not generate the same innovations because incentives will not be present there. Or if I think about the feedback between technology and investment in human capital, if we live in a world in which, in fact, education is not available for most people, we don't have institutions that provide education, then despite the fact that technological progress may generate the incentive to invest in human capital, invest in education, this will not occur. So the idea is that unified growth theory is basically developing the mechanism that allows you to understand this phase transition. Why is it the case that over most of human history, we were in a Malthusian epoch, and then at a certain point, spontaneously and very dramatically, we move into the sustained growth regime? And why do we see this increase in the gap in the wealth of nations? But Naturally, if we think about institutional characteristics or cultural characteristics, they can govern the pace of this transition. Okay, they're not the forces that are moving this transition, but they are forces that can govern the pace. So typically, the metaphor that I use when people ask me about institutions is the following: I would like to think about institutions as the oil that lubricate the wheels of a moving train. If the train is in a standstill, even if you lubricate the wheels, there will be no movement. But if the train is moving because of the forces that I mentioned, then having better institutions, having better or more growth-conducive cultural characteristics can expedite the transition. So there is an interaction between the two. But as I said, what I'm identifying in unified growth theory are the fundamental forces, this interaction between size of the population, the composition of the population, and technological progress that inevitably generate a spontaneous takeoff, investment in human capital, demographic transition, and a movement into sustained economic growth. Now, whether it will occur, say, in 1750 in England, the theory is silent about it. Naturally, we need to look at historical forces and how, in fact, institutional and cultural factors affected this.
So why couldn't the tipping point, why couldn't the wheel be the tipping point of just passing a threshold for productivity of an individual farmer based on mechanized agriculture? So suddenly one farmer can now feed 10 or 100 people, and the introduction of new crops from the Americas, like potatoes, to Europe, which then means reduction in famines and a greater productivity, the most calories per acre, and that sort of thing. So why couldn't it just be some technological tipping point rather than, you know, any other explanation?
Okay, so first, technology is very important, and there is an element of technological tipping point. But the important part to note, and this is something that I did not explain, is that over human existence, we do see more and more rapid technological progress. But ultimately, technological progress is, as I said before, generating an increase in the size of the population. So it appears that the world is in a stable equilibrium. And then suddenly, we are escaping from a Malthusian equilibrium. We're escaping from a black hole. And how can you escape from a black hole? It appears contradiction in terms. And the idea in unified growth theory, which is based on mathematical theory known as bifurcation theory, is that there is a variable, or there is a certain element that is operating behind the scene, okay? And once this variable reaches a critical point, there is a phase transition that permits this Malthusian equilibrium simply to vanish and the economy to move into a better equilibrium. Just to use the right metaphor, think about boiling water. So you basically have water on the stove and you start to heat the water. Initially, you don't see any action. Nevertheless, we know that the molecules start to move more and more rapidly, and at a certain point where the temperature will reach 100 degrees, then we know that, in fact, there will be a phase transition from liquid into gas. This is precisely what happens in unified growth theory. For a long period of time, there is no change, and the economy is in a Malthusian equilibrium. But something is percolating behind the scene. It's deceiving to think that no change is occurring in the Malthusian epoch. As I said before, the size of the population is increasing dramatically. The pace of technological progress is increasing dramatically, up to a point in which suddenly people must invest in human capital in order to cope with the changes in the technological environment. Previously, you can simply observe your father, you can observe your mother, and basically learn the necessary traits without formal education. But there is a point in which the environment, the technological environment, is changing so rapidly that we need to start to invest in education. At this moment, this positive link between population and technology is being separated. People are no longer converting their income into more children. They convert their income into more educated children on the account of the number of children. And at the moment that this separation is taking place, now technology can boost the standard of living rather than boost the size of the population. Okay, so these are the critical elements here that must be understood. And as I said, think about institution and culture. These are forces that can affect the pace of the transition, but they're not the one that are moving the transition. So naturally, when we think about, as I said before, of Homo sapiens 300,000 years ago, there are no institutions. Nevertheless, there is progress. There are more people, better technology, more people, better technology. This is prior to the emergence of any type of formal institutions or even informal institutions. And then, at a certain point when technology is evolving so rapidly, and naturally people would like to protect themselves in the context of property rights, so people need education institutions in order to educate their children, all these elements become critical to allow the process to continue in the way that it continues.
What you're describing matches what we see in the cultural expansion and population growth after the Industrial Revolution perfectly. It's like there things are pretty stagnant for a while. Everything's pretty much the same. And then all of a sudden with technology and as it advances in certain cultures, people begin to shift their priorities from having huge families into smaller, high-quality families with children that are educated. And that moment was kind of a tipping point where everything changed and our priorities today just look way different than they did before.
One of the main challenges that I faced at the time is how to orchestrate the phase transition. I mean, how can it be that the world was basically in a Malthusian equilibrium for most of human existence, and suddenly we see, as I said, very flat, and suddenly a dramatic take of how can this be generated spontaneously? And the methodology that I used mathematically was precisely this methodology of bifurcation theory, basically saying something was percolating behind the scene for a long period of time. This can be the size of the population. This can see the change in the composition of the population, either genetically or culturally. And ultimately, this brings technology up to a point in which it evolves so rapidly that people must invest in education and consequently, at a certain point, they must economize on the size of their family, and this permits the movement into sustained economic growth.
Have you found this idea to be controversial with anybody, or what controversy have you run into, and how have you dealt with that?
So at the time when the paper Natural Selection, The Origin of Economic Growth was published, I think it was it didn't generate any controversy, and I suppose that, I mean, the way that we thought about it is not in the context of differential evolutionary processes in different types of the world. We thought about the model of the world. The world is unified in some sense. There are no countries, there are no borders. And we thought about these evolutionary processes, and this did not generate any controversy at the time. Now, when the paper that appeared recently in Nature was published, and in fact, there were some reactions, but not major reactions, in which people felt that perhaps it's hard to believe that evolutionary processes were important. And what we showed in this study was something very simple. If you look at the population of Quebec, that's a very interesting laboratory, because basically we had data virtually or nearly all the population in Quebec, people that arrived in 1608 with the establishment of the colony, till 1800, so about 500,000 people. And we were able to trace, based on parish record, individuals and their descendants four generations later. And therefore, we were able to count whether a particular strategy was more powerful than other strategy. And what we showed is that paradoxically, perhaps, people that had higher predisposition towards fertility, people that were able to conceive earlier than others immediately after the marriage, were not evolutionary winners. So those individuals that were able to deliver their first child as close to the marriage as possible had more children in the end. On average, they had 10 children, but ultimately less great grandchildren. And those that had what we called moderate fecundity, those that had fewer children initially, were able to invest more in each of them, and consequently these children were more educated, married earlier, married better, and had more surviving children in the long run. So there was a huge gap between those individuals that were very fertile initially and those individuals that that ultimately had larger reproductive success. So the idea was basically to support precisely this paper of mine from 2002, in which the idea was that predisposition towards quality rather than quantity may be the evolutionary winning strategy. And what we showed in the Quebec data is that those that has sort of extreme predisposition towards quantity were not evolutionary winner. Those that had moderate fecundity were the evolutionary winner. And moderate fecundity implies, by default, predisposition towards quality. Because naturally, if you have three children rather than 10, you have more resources to invest in.
Yeah. It sounds like you're suggesting that this was the moment in time where the change happened, where fewer children was evolutionarily incentivized, because these people who rushed into having kids and just had huge families, it seems like they were going off of the logic of their ancestors, maybe, like that they should just have a bunch of kids. So was this the moment where this change happened, and were there just a small select group of people that were kind of early adopters of it or something?
You're talking about it as not a choice, actually, because this is before birth control. So presumably people who get married are having sex and therefore having children. So it's not even that they chose to delay having children. You're saying it's literally what happened biologically, and there was an impact of that.
I see.
So it's not
I
a cultural
see.
Thing. Yeah.
The data that we have is really not based on choices. These are devoted Catholics that basically marry in order to conceive. And some of them are more successful in conceiving, say, within 38 weeks of the date of marriage, and others are less successful. And those that are conceiving earlier are consistently more productive. Perhaps they have higher sperm count, and consequently, they have more children in the end of their life. But ultimately, they're not the evolutionary winner, paradoxically, in the long run, because having more children is not the right strategy. But from this, we can learn that if, in fact, people have preferences towards quantity and quality, as is present in other species as well, then the quality strategy will be selected, at least moderate tendency towards quality will be selected as opposed to quantity strategy. So this was not necessarily, I don't think that this was controversial relative to other issues that I was engaged in the context of unified growth
theory. Yeah, and to be clear, you're not really talking about changes to actual humans in terms of evolutionary drift of the median or the mean population. You're talking about just within the natural variance within the population, one end of that is favored over another. So it doesn't have to have lots of generations, basically.
And another thing that I should emphasize is what is unique about Quebec is that very few people, about 100 people, are arriving to Quebec in 1608, French soldiers. And the capacity of the environment is significantly higher than the size of the population. And that's the reason that population is growing very rapidly. As I said, in our data, the average fertility is 10, okay? And the average number of great children, grandchildren that people have is about 250. It's incomprehensible. So if you think about Homo sapiens escaping Africa or starting to migrate out of Africa, every time that they reach a new economic niche, naturally they could have multiplied very rapidly because, again, the carrying capacity of this niche was an order of magnitude larger than the population that arrived to this niche. Okay? So I suppose that this is precisely the time period in which this type of evolutionary processes took place, and the composition of the population may have changed. That's my hypothesis.
Well, that is fascinating stuff. Andrew, do you have anything else you want to ask Oded before we wind this down?
So, yeah, because it's not talking about sort of a mean change in evolution, I think it is definitely a lot more plausible. What do you think the relative magnitude of this effect is compared with the relative magnitude of exponential increase in technology? So you're talking about these multiple factors. Are they equal, or do you think? Because to me, it seems like this is very different from any other theory I've ever heard about economic growth, because they're pretty much entirely based on technology. And I always thought. of it as technology driving the curve. So basically, human population responds to technology, not changes in the human population driving technology. It's sort of like a reversal of cause and effect. I think that's the main difference here. So what do you think the relative magnitude is of the evolutionary effect versus the technological exponential growth effect?
So as I said, I think that the two processes are inseparable.
So it's hard to tell. Is that what you're saying?
Progress is not manna from heaven. Technological progress is a byproduct of the scale of the population and the composition of the population. So as I said, even if we shut off entirely the changes in the composition of the population, we wouldn't have seen what you define as exponential growth in the absence of the feedback between population and technology. The fact that when technology is advancing, provides people with more resources, they take these resources, they consume part of it, but they produce more children, and these children ultimately are advancing the technological frontier even faster than before. So, yes, if you think about technological progress as an exogenous force, okay, that is some sort of a manna from heaven, you can explain the world. But naturally, it's not an exogenous force. What we would like to understand is why is it the case that inevitably technology is advancing exponentially? And the reason, as I said, is precisely this positive feedback loop between technology and population, regardless of whether the composition of the population is changing. You ask me, I think that inevitably the composition of the population must have changed because of the forces that I mentioned before. Because of the fact that this is a time period in which individuals that command more resources have higher reproductive success. And if these resources are related to your traits, then your traits will become more and more prevalent in the population, provided that these traits are transmitted intergenerationally.
Do you think it might have any impact on plummeting fertility rates today, the fact that it's almost taken to an extreme? So people are continuing to delay having children. And I think this year is the lowest birth rate year of any in U.S. history, basically. And the fewest babies born, so the fewest in absolute number, I think, since the 1970s or something that is remarkable considering the growing population. But certainly the birth rates are the lowest ever, probably. So do you think there's some danger that we're kind of going towards a cliff where delaying having children is so favored, both culturally and also possibly genetically, that it's what's driving these problems with fertility?
I can certainly say that based on the theory that I developed, the theory is silent about the long-run equilibrium in terms of fertility. It's completely plausible and consistent with the theory that that fertility will drop asymptotically to a very, very low level, certainly below replacement. So there is nothing in the model, nothing in reality that is pushing individuals towards, say, fertility that is precisely at replacement. It is quite possible that fertility will maintain its course. And again, in the absence of some sort of a policy, it's quite possible that selfishly, given the fact that we live in an era where technology is evolving so rapidly, the cost of raising children is so high, and in fact, education is so important, that people will gradually economize further on the number of children, will invest enormously in the education of their children, and we will see a gradual decline in fertility further below replacement.
So is it possible by that logic that we could reach a point where the evolutionary incentives revert back to where they were in the Malthusian epoch?
It's quite possible. I mean, the theoretical viewpoint is not, you reach a rate of technological progress and a level of education that I don't think that the world will revert in terms of income per capita into a Malthusian world. But in terms of population patterns, it's certainly possible that, in fact, we will see changes in the composition of the population. We talked about changes initially in favor of people that are complementary to the technological environment. It's possible that, in fact, we will see precisely the opposite forces, in the sense that people that command less resources have, on average, more children, And if these people are less complementary to the technological environment, perhaps we will see some sort of changes in the composition of the population that will have an adverse effect on technological progress. Whether this will take us back to the Malthusian equilibrium, the model doesn't suggest that this is the case.
Or possibly some kind of separation in the population where you have two separate diverging elements of the population where one factor is... It's not necessarily to have a single equilibrium. It could be have two separate means, basically. Yeah, two separate concentrations.
Oded, what's next for you? What are you working on now that you've been working on unified growth theory for, I guess, 17 years now, and this new paper just came out. So are you continuing to hone in on what this theory means, or are you moving on to other topics?
So broadly speaking, I'm interested in deep-rooted factors of comparative development and how events that occurred very much in the distant past are still affecting us. And part of what I've been exploring in the past years is the evolution of preferences, broadly speaking, why some of us are loss-averse and others are not, why some of us are risk-averse and others are not, and how is it related to the geographical and climatic characteristics that were characterizing our ancestral environment. So this is one element that is sort of characterizing my research. And in fact, perhaps the most exciting news in terms of the public as a whole is that, in fact, I'm about to release a book that is based on the ideas of unified growth theory that will be very broad and very accessible to the public. It will not be based on modeling, and it will basically survey unified growth theory and comparative development for the broad public. In fact, we just sent this book to the publisher in Israel, so the first version will be released in Hebrew. And then we hope to translate it into English by December. And again, our hope is to compete with books such as the one of Jared Diamond or perhaps Sapiens of my compatriot Noah Harari. So that's basically the niche that we're aiming to. And time will tell whether we'll be successful in competing in this niche. But I think that the material is fascinating. So I'm looking forward to see the reaction of the public to this release.
Well, we wish you all the best, and I can't wait to check out that new book. And thanks for making the time today. This has been an awesome chat. I want to encourage all the listeners to check out Oded's books. I believe you have two, right? Discrete Dynamical Systems and Unified Growth Theory?
Indeed.
Okay, great. Well, best of luck on your third release, and thanks again for making the time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for interviewing with us, and thanks to the listeners for listening today.
Yeah, if you guys listening want to support us, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Those are so helpful. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider. And Oded, do you use social media at all?
I started to use Twitter, but only very recently.
What is your Twitter handle? I want to plug it.
It is Galore Oded.
Last name, first name.
Yes.
GALORODED. Galore Oded. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next Monday.
Thank you very much.